Hello, and welcome to Holton Village. Today's date is Monday, July 28th, 2003. Today's session is Sin, Sins, and Deadly Sins. Session 1, the 7 Deadly Sins, a Bible study with Brad Beto. Number is BIB2003-01. Let's listen in.
My name is Brad Beto. I teach pastoral theology at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio. This is my 6th time at Holton Village, stretching back to 1979. So if anybody's been here back in those years, why let me know. Maybe we know some of the same people. Glad to be back. Glad to be the Bible study leader for this week and next week. And I'll say more about that in just a second. You just heard me signal Jackie to turn on the recording device. All of these sessions are recorded, and you can get those if you're interested in doing that. What I want to say to you is that they ask each of us as session leaders to sign a paper giving our consent that they're recorded, but because I certainly hope and expect that this will be conversational and that you will all be participating too, you just know that you're being recorded, and if at any point that feels like that's not a good thing for you, why you can ask Jackie to turn things off for a minute, or let me know later and we can monitor that a little bit. I would hope that doesn't inhibit any of the kind of conversation that we'll want to have about sin. When I was asked what I might like to teach, I suggested this theme of the 7 deadly sins. I've been teaching a course for a few years at Trinity Seminary on this topic. And then the response came back, how would you like to do this as the morning Bible study for 2 weeks? And I thought, well, that'll be fun and an interesting challenge, and we'll bend that in the direction of the theme for the summer, Healing the World. And so I've selected a different text for each day. This will not be, moving through one gospel or one book. We're going to jump around both testaments and various pieces here and there, expanding and elaborating on the theme as we go. But I think that the major tie-in here is that I want to talk not only about sin, but I want to talk about why sin is important, and because I think that if we are to enjoy our salvation and move toward it, it's pretty important to have an understanding of our sin to begin with. And if we understand salvation to mean health and wholeness, then we're right on track with what the theme is that we're working here, and I'll try to unfold that as we go. Let me say also, every session at Holton, they always ask us to make a kind of freestanding session, not that dependent on the ones before, so that people come and go so much. I will probably violate that principle. I don't know how else we can do that. If you do the 7 deadly sins, there's a certain sequence to that. I'll try to make sure at the beginning of each session that you catch up enough that nobody is left behind, but that's also a not so subtle ploy to get you to come every day and soak it up as much as you can. So let me say also, here's how I view my function in this. I assume that I kind of steer things, and maybe I supply enough energy. I'm sort of like first gear here. I get enough energy going, it gets us moving, and maybe shift us into second gear. But if we're really going to get into high gear with this, then it's up to you to provide the energy and the power and the conversation and the ideas that may move that along. I've got plenty to talk about. I could go 3 or 4 hours here, and I'm sure you don't want that, so it'll be important for you to climb in. But I'll steer that in kind of along the lines of what I put on the board behind me. Those are the highlights that I think we can kind of move through here to give you some idea of where we're headed. So that might, if you see a topic later down, that might pull you in, that we'll be picking that up, and you can time your comments and questions. Let's begin then with a word of prayer. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Gracious God, we come before you desiring to know ourselves better and yet knowing enough about ourselves to know that we're not always honest with that prayer. Sin has touched us in every way, and our sin has touched others in so many ways. Hear us in our best and most earnest selves, asking that you fill our lives with your light and with your hope, that you give us the courage to examine our own sinfulness, and the joy and the health of salvation that can come to us through the free gift that is yours, given to us in Jesus Christ. Bless our time together, that it might be a sanctified time, that our thinking and praying and studying and learning together might be to the glory of your reign in the world. We pray in the name of the risen Christ. Okay. I'm always amazed what's in the library at Holden Village. You can count on good things being here. And I obviously couldn't bring with me all the books that I wanted to lift up and point out to you. But here's an interesting one that I'll refer to a few times along the way. The Dynamics of Sanctification, written by a Lutheran pastoral theologian, William Hume. Some of you who've been around long enough can remember him. Taught at Luther Seminary for a good number of years. I know that that Daryl's going to be teaching on Luther later through the week and later today. As I gathered, on themes other than justification, and Lutherans have become so expert in justification, we forget there are a few other things to pay attention to. Bill Hume sort of lifted up sanctification as something that does have some connection and Lutherans might want to pay attention to. And here's just a two-sentence thought from this book of his. He says near the beginning, in our complex existence, the choice is often between a greater and a lesser evil, rather than between evil and good. In spite of this fact, it is essential for sanctification that not only the lesser evil be chosen, but that all behavior be morally identified. Think about that and let that soak in, that everything has a moral dimension to it. And it's important to work toward identifying just what that is, given that it's not always possible to be absolutely clear, what is totally good and what is totally evil, the gray and ambiguity surround all of that. But that doesn't suspend for us the responsibility of doing this sort of moral examination. And we're going to pick that up in a minute here as we look at some of Paul's writing to the Philippians as he talks about the importance of corporately working out whatever it is that salvation means. But first, let me... few words on just why, well, I've already started that, I guess, why all this matters. I think it doesn't do any particularly good to just wallow in our sense of sinfulness. And I should say, by the way, I answer this right up front. This is not a how to do it session. Students always, when they're signing up for this course at the seminary, have to ask that question. No, I assume nobody needs any more information on how to do sin. We're all experts in our own way, and one of the great misnomers probably in the tradition is original sin, because truth be told, there's very little original about it, and boringly similar over the generations. We've got it down to a fine art. If there is some how to do it element here, I think it's probably on the side of virtue, the cardinal virtues, and as we get deeper into the week, we'll touch on some of those as they correspond with the various sins. But mostly in the how-to-do-it department, I'd say this is about trying to be honest with ourselves. If we can come out of today with a little better sense of what sinfulness means and how we can be honest about that, then I think that's probably a pretty good thing. Another reason, I guess, why I think all this matters so much is that we live in a culture and society that is fairly easily confused about the meaning of sin, and I think it's incumbent on us to explain that and address that as best we can. Just one little story to get us started. I think this had something to do with why I got interested in this kind of a topic many, many years ago. Way back when I was in grade school, I guess, there was a boy named Steve who went to my church. And Steve was just different. I don't know how you describe it. Somebody today would probably have some kind of clinical diagnosis for Steve's situation. It was just different. He was a nervous kid. He was easily agitated, and as you can imagine, that meant that kids picked on him a lot, and he was pretty marginalized and didn't have a lot of friends. He lived on a farm, and I remember somewhere along in high school for his 4-H project, he raised hogs. Well, that led to an unfortunate nickname. He became Piggy forever after. And I think in our first year of high school, kids picking on him during gym class took his shoes one day. So after gym class, he had no street shoes to change into. Coach got very upset about that and decided that until he found out who took Steve's shoes, the whole class was going to run. So for about 6 weeks, that section of gym, as I would walk by in my weight study hall, they were running laps. Steve was sitting up there in the bleachers doing his homework, and everybody, of course, that And after about 6 weeks of that, somebody found Steve's shoes stuffed under a locker. Nobody ever fessed up, but the coach gave up. And it was that kind of behavior that just attended all the time. Girls, I found, were often the meanest to Steve. You know, they'd flirt with him a little bit, but you knew there wasn't anything going on there, and it was just hard to watch. What was interesting to me, though, was that when kids were being especially mean to Steve, what he would say to them was, "You're evil. You're just evil." I mean, he just named it, and I think he was right. I mean, he paid attention in confirmation class. And, you know, to put a kind of theological name on that sort of behavior was really interesting. About 2 years after high school, Steve didn't go to college. He went to work on the farm for his dad. About 2 years after college, in the middle of summer, Steve was driving a tractor one day from one field to another down the edge of the highway, and just went over a little rise in the highway, and a semi-truck came up behind and didn't see him and hit him from behind, and he very seriously injured, was in the hospital for a couple days, and then he died from those injuries. I thought it was very interesting that at the funeral home, lots of those kids from my high school graduating class showed up. And I didn't hear anybody overtly saying, "Hey, we're really sorry for the way we treated Steve." But you also had a sense that they knew that this kid, odd as he was and so forth, had something about the moral nature of the universe pretty profoundly figured out. He knew the difference between what was right and wrong, and he knew the difference between what was kind and unkind, and what was good and bad, and he just, in his own simple way, he sort of named it. A lot, I think, can unfold from that story, at least it has for me. A reminder to me of how important it is, that as Bill Hume has said here, that for the sake of our sanctification, for the betterment of the healing of the whole world, we're all needing to work toward an understanding so that our behavior can be morally identified. And so thank God for the Steves of the world who are just willing to say that maybe where it needs to be said. Way back when, actually about the time that Steve and I were graduating from high school, Carl Menninger published this book. Some of you have been around long enough, probably seen it, Whatever Became of Sin. One of the most interesting things about this book is that Menninger was not a professional theologian. He was a psychiatrist. His father was a pastor. He was not, you know, unschooled in theology. But he founded and ran for a number of years the famous Menninger Foundation in Topeka, Kansas. A lot of clergy went there to get better and to learn. And what Carl Menninger found out over the years was that all these theologians and clergy types would come to his center there in Topeka, and nobody wanted to talk about sin. They all had some clinical understanding for what was wrong and so forth. And finally, he said, "You know, folks, it's part of the tradition. Maybe we ought to name it." And so he wrote this book and asked the question, "Well, whatever became of the language of sin?" He had two ideas about that, basically, what happened. One was that when we get uncomfortable with the theological language of sin, we operate, he said, either out of, we tend to operate out of either a legal model then or a medical model. On the legal side of things, this is what Barbara Brown Taylor in her book Speaking of Sin, which I think may be in the bookstore now, I asked maybe that it could be. She says this legal model is kind of a sense of, well, you know the difference between no fault and full fault insurance and so forth. This is like full fault. The legal model says, it's all on you. You made bad decisions. You're totally responsible for what's wrong. The individual choice is at the center of all this. And if you write enough guidelines and laws and supervise people carefully enough, you can circumscribe this kind of bad behavior. And so this becomes a kind of full fault model that's made better when you have a tough, tight legal law-oriented system surrounding it. And to no surprise, certain expressions of the Christian tradition, more at the what we might call the conservative end of the spectrum, have tended to gravitate toward, more or less toward some kind of understanding like this. With at the other end of the spectrum being what many are called the medical model of sin, or Barbara Brown Taylor refers to as the no-fault version of sin, where in this model, sin is referred to along the lines of some kind of sickness or illness. Now, obviously, these two points aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, there is individual responsibility. There are elements of illness and sickness. I'm just sketching out the most extreme positions at either end here for the moment. But in this kind of medical no-fault understanding of sin, everybody is understood to be vulnerable. Nobody can ever avoid sin. It's so much a part of everything. So instead of any kind of sense of judgment in a theological way, rather we receive diagnosis. Or we might say, rather than doing any sort of penance for our sin, we receive treatment. I think diagnosis is important, and I think treatment is very helpful. And I also think that either end of the spectrum, to the exclusion of the other end, doesn't give us a very complete picture. And obviously, some of what we might call more liberal expressions of the Christian tradition have pushed more toward a kind of medical model. Well, that's why it's important that people on all sides keep talking to each other so we don't get bracketed off in kind of exclusive position. Between these two models of legal and medical, one of the things that Carl Menninger said 30 plus years ago was, he said, here's my proposal. It says it's for the revival or reassertion of personal responsibility in all human acts, good and bad. Not total responsibility, but not zero either. And he was looking for a kind of third way that could keep a finger on each end of the spectrum and guide things sort of toward the middle. I think the whole point of these Bible studies, I hope this week and next, if they work, is that two things, I guess. One, that they'll help us to take greater ownership of our own sinfulness, understand that better. And two, give us greater and clearer hope regarding our salvation. And as I mentioned a moment ago, if we understand by salvation, Latin root for that word means health, wholeness, shalom, we'll talk about that in a second. Then we're right on track with the theme, I hope, for the healing of the world. I'll give you one last thought here from Bill Hume before we leave him. He said, the gravity of sin is obviously minimized when it is explained by factors other than our own responsibility. Well, again, I would say, like Carl Menninger, not total responsibility, but not zero either. Let's see where we fit into all of this. So with that, let's turn to the text here, which is Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 through 13. Now, I assume we've got a number of different translations in front of us. That's a good thing, because there's one particular verse I want to get zeroed in on here in a minute, and a variety of translations may help us to understand and unpack that one. Is there any, the Bible's over here, help yourself if you need them. Any enterprising person who's already put their finger on this text and might like to read it for us? You got it? Okay. First 13 verses of chapter 2 of Philippians.
If then there is any encouragement in Christ, any consolation from love, any sharing in the Spirit, any compassion and sympathy, make my joy complete. Be of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility regard others as better than yourselves. Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, and being found in human form. He humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God also highly exalted him and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Therefore, my beloved, just as you have always obeyed me, not only in my presence, but much more now in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, enabling you both to will and to work for his good pleasure.
Thank you. How many preachers do we have in the room here? People who occasionally stand up. All right. You may all like to be reminded that this text comes up every year on Passion Sunday. All right, so think ahead here. The rest of us, we hear it at least once a year.
We also sing it.
Oh, right, obviously. Most of us are pretty acquainted with this text, I think. This is, as you may know, Paul is likely borrowing in some fashion from a hymn of the early Christian tradition here. And the thrust of this hymn is the faithful servanthood of Jesus, and that Jesus had set all of his heavenly prerogatives aside for our sake. And had come to be a servant in the fullest kind of sense of the word. In a sense that, if we had the time, we could go back and read into chapter 1 and then move ahead a little bit. These verses are in some sense an interruption of the flow of the thought of what Paul is presenting. He begins back in verse 29 of chapter 1, and then he picks it up here at the end of what we just read in verse 12, was the thought that that God has somehow graciously allowed the Philippians to face the same kind of struggles that Paul has faced. Indeed, Paul thinks that Jesus himself had faced, and namely that this was a struggle for obedience. And so at the end of what we just read here, or had read for us in verse 12, Paul's picking up again this thought that in light of this hymn about Christ and Christ's faithful obedience and servanthood, he seems to be saying to the Philippians, you also have been given this opportunity to be obedient. You have been obedient, so keep on working toward being obedient. And I think one of the theological points here is that this is not a sort of if-then theology that Paul is presenting. He's not saying, now if you're really good enough and can finally get this obedience thing all worked out, then God's going to pay off and reward you. Rather, it seems to me it's Paul saying, because of Christ's obedience and the great love and the reality of the resurrection, the way that you're incorporated into all that, therefore, you are free to struggle honestly, face things realistically, and work toward the obedient, sanctified life. The pressure's off in a sense. The outcome is assured. You're freed up to get busy on this now. And then we come to the verse I really want to focus on here, the very interesting line in verse 12. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Well, now if you cut that verse out, absent the context and so forth, that's about as un-Lutheran of a thought as would just scare most Lutherans to think about that. But there it is. I mean, it's in Scripture. We have to deal with it somehow and figure out what that might mean. I don't think that that means something like save your own soul. Obviously, there's more context here to it than just that. Might help us to know that the work out, that word that Paul is using, means something more like fulfill or actualize, bring to fruition, something like that, bring to completion. One commentator suggested it means something like don't be satisfied with partial salvation. Work things out as completely as possible. Work it all the way through. And Paul's, if get it back in context, what Paul seems to be suggesting is working things all the way out is possible because God is working in us. And God has already been at work in all of creation through Jesus. And it's also maybe interesting to note that in Greek here, this is plural. The you part is you all. Work out among all yourselves here in the whole Christian community your corporate, plural, own salvation. So the sin business is not a privatistic, just me and my own stuff, although that's not unimportant, but this is something that we're all in together. How we behave and how we comport ourselves matters not just for each of us individually, but for the good of the community, indeed for the healing of the whole world. I guess I hear this passage then as both calling us but also freeing us to be clear about our own sin. Paul seems to be saying here, unidentified sin is going to result in a kind of partial salvation, and who wants that? I mean, why not go for the whole fullest package, the biggest, under, you know, the most enjoyment of all that God has to give you? And that working out with fear and trembling, I think for Paul means you got to be honest about your own situation here. Well, let me pause here, though. That's some of what I think this means to me. How does this text strike you in light of what we've been talking about so far? Questions that it might raise for you? Yeah.
Well, again, on that key passage, very little response. We say, Luther said, I cannot by my own reason or strength come to the Lord God. So how do we do it? By grace. I mean, that is a real important passage. But I guess the working response, maybe somebody else will respond differently.
Yeah, to understand there's a freedom to do this kind of hard work. The freedom doesn't excuse you from the hard work. It makes possible the hard work. And you don't have to do the work in order to get the freedom. The freedom's the gift you get at the beginning to get you started. Yeah, very helpful. Others?
I have a message.
Oh, okay. What is,
and actually, I like Peterson, the way he puts it, because it doesn't talk about the same way that the new read the RSV, right? But this is what I'm getting at, friends, is that you should simply keep on doing what you've been doing from the beginning. When I was living among you, you lived in responsive obedience. Now that I'm separate from you, keep it up. Better yet, redouble your efforts. Be energetic in your life of salvation, reverent and sensitive before God. That energy is God's energy. I like that part of it, because that puts the emphasis on God. An energy deep within you, God himself willing and working at what will give him the most glory. Huh. That's kind of Lutheran in a way.
People have accused Eugene Peterson of being overly Lutheran.
Not overly?
Not overly.
Yeah. No, he's not. No.
Anybody else? All right.
Affirm what's being said. Luther not only said, I can't do it, but one of the gifts God gives is the indwelling of the Holy Spirit. And so I think that's present here, God working within you. And that's what's the motive, the impetus for working out.
I'm going to be interested in your sessions this week. I think Luther had a couple of things once in a while to say about sanctification.
Yes.
Somewhat eclipsed by our emphasis on justification. Not that that's wrong. I mean, that's one of our great gifts out of the Lutheran tradition to the whole church. But maybe there are other little things also to be lifted up there and paid attention to. Well, let's take a minute here then and take a crack at defining sin. I just toss out some ideas and things that have come to you. If you've got a quick, you know, half sentence opportunity to define sin, what are some of your favorite ways to articulate that? Perhaps biblical images, but maybe others also. If I walk up to you on the street and say, "So, this sin thing, what is it?" what do you say?
Thinking of yourself first.
Ah, okay.
Willful disobedience.
Say that again?
Willful disobedience.
Ah, okay. That both parts of that are important. It's willful, but it's disobedient. Right, okay.
Separation.
Ah, okay.
Separation. Yeah.
Brokenness.
All right. Yep.
Not being in integrity.
Ha.
That would be unease.
Unease or
creating problems.
Ah, okay. And that's kind of
willfully.
Willful. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, there's a difference between my 5-year-old creating a problem,
right.
But willfully knowing that you're causing grief.
Just before I came over here, our 2-year-old Trevor stuck his toothbrush down the sink. That trap thing you can't get down there. Guess you. Now, if our 11-year-old had done that, we'd have a different conversation. Still a little bit of disruption of shalom and shalom. But you're right. That's important to remember that. And again, here's some of that difference between the legal and the medical and the full fault and the no fault, and how do you get that into the right perspective?
I mean, for a 2-year-old to throw a rock at a squirrel and try to kill it or hurt it, and for me to do that, totally different thing.
Right.
I think one of the deadliest sins is arrogance.
Well, pride is number one on all lists. We'll be getting to that on Wednesday. But we're back to what you said at the beginning.
The conscious and unconscious. I mean, as an adult, we're conscious of certain sins. But as we become more and more aware of the world and the people in the world, and then what's happening on our behalf in the community that we actually affect through globalization or our national policies, then, you know, then we get into the level of maybe unconscious sin. It's something that we're called to bring into consciousness.
Well, and we're already starting to hint at, I'm going to elaborate this more in a minute, that I think an important tension we always need to keep together here, that there is an element of personal culpability, but there's something larger than the personal in play here too. Something more tragic, more universal, more original, the tradition has tended to call it. We'll hold that for just a second. Any other definitions? Any biblical definitions, especially? Yeah.
Well, I just think of the story of Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the myth that describes our sin. Mm-hmm. That it is, you know, it's unconscious in a way, and yet it's also conscious. And
so what did they do wrong in that story?
Disobey God.
They wanted to be God.
God said, "Do not eat from that tree."
They wanted knowledge. Mm-hmm.
They wanted to be
Yeah.
Well, what if the snake never told them to do it?
I mean, all the snake said was, "You could be like God."
Yeah.
Sure.
But he
so bad about that? That was terrible to me. And the result was. Relationships are messed up then. I mean, that's what that story would have us understand. Relationships are messed up forever after because of this willful kind of disobedience.
one way to describe the two elements too is personal and corporate.
Right, right. Well, and along that line, one of the biblical images for sin is, of course, missing the mark, that idea. And in Barbara Brown Taylor's book, speaking of sin, she has an interesting illustration. She said when she was in an archery class in high school, they got to go out to the athletic field, you know, and they'd shoot at the targets and whatever, try to hit the mark. And one of her classmates, apparently, who was just fooling around, twanged an arrow that went clear over the targets and off the you know, athletic field and zipped some neighbor's dog in the tail and actually yard wouldn't hurt him. But a lot of yelping and running around here going on for a few minutes. And out of that, she pointed out that our wrongdoing doesn't merely miss the mark. It often hits someone else. And so there is, it's not just my personal, you know, stuff, but my personal stuff has a way of messing things up for a lot of other people. So there's this personal corporate dimension always going on. One of the other books that I asked the bookstore to have this week, Cornelius Plantinga, a book called Not the Way It's Supposed to Be. That's pretty much his definition of sin, in shorthand. And I've used this book as a text when I do this course on the deadly sins, and I find it really quite helpful. His little deeper definition in this book is that sin, he says, is culpable shalom breaking. So where the shalom of God's world is disrupted and there's culpability for that, he says, let's name that for what it is and we'll call it sin. The first chapter of the book is entitled The Vandalism of Shalom. A lot of different ways I'm supposed to say that. One of my favorites comes from C.S. Lewis. In his book in the Space Trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, he talks about, I'm going to try it. If you've read that book, great. If you haven't, you should, whatever. But he's got a person here who's traveled to another planet trying to explain to another race of people what sin is in a world where sin has not entered, it hasn't fallen yet. And he describes bent humanity. And I don't think that was original Lewis. I think he got that from somewhere in ancient part of the tradition. But you think about that. I remember in the dining hall in college, students used to like to take the silverware, it wasn't silver, I mean, stainless steel, bend the fork tines around or whatever. And you could straighten that stuff, you know, you could take a fork like that and straighten it back out. It's still serviceable as a fork, but you'll never get it back into the shape that it was supposed to be in at the beginning. And that's sort of an interesting way to look at the shape of the world, that it's been bent. Not beyond all recognition, but not in its original state either. Well, Barbara Brown Taylor, in her book, Speaking of Sin, says that we'll know what sin is when we discover those experiences that make part of us die. It's a different way, perhaps, to understand death, that death comes in increments and many shapes and sizes, and it's not just a one-time thing that happens at the end. Any other thoughts on defining sin?
We've touched on this a number of ways, but I think I found myself responding somewhat to the idea of conscious, willful, because I think I've been engaged in sinful behavior a lot in my life that was had consequences for other people and broke the shalom of the world without being conscious of it. And I don't think we can limit our understanding of sinful behavior to sin. Just those things you're aware of.
Yeah. And I want to get right into that. Thanks for the bridge, yeah.
Yes, I understand what he's saying from that same perspective. I think of that the human tendency always is that we want to define sin on the basis of age or experience. Sin is sin. It's the separation from God, whether we are aware of it or not.
But it's not only what I do, it's sort of my natural bent, or my, you know, that is unconscious, that gradually through the sanctifying thing, I can become, hopefully more, at least more conscious of personally, you know, as well as how it affects, I mean, it's both. Certainly, I have to know what is unconscious in me, what I do out of unknowing that also. And I'm just knowing that.
And it's tricky.
It's tricky.
Let me just, by way of defining here for a second, a paragraph from Planting's book about shalom. Now, so by contrast, we maybe get a better sense of sin when we get a sense of how we define shalom. He's sort of working out in this chapter, the vandalism of shalom, what a vision of shalom might be. And so he says, it would include, for instance, strong marriages and secure children. Nations and races in this brave new world would treasure differences in other nations and races as attractive, important, complementary. In the process of making decisions, men would defer to women and women to men until a crisis arose, and then with good humor all around, the person more naturally competent in the area of the crisis would resolve it to the satisfaction and pleasure of both. Government officials would still take office. Somebody has to decide which streets are cleaned on Tuesday and which on Wednesday. But to nobody's surprise, they would tell the truth, freely praise the virtues of other public officials. Public telephone books would be left intact. Highway overpasses would be free of graffiti. Tow truck drivers and erring motorists would be serene on inner city streets. Business associates would rejoice in one another's promotions. Middling Harvard students would respect the Phi Beta Kappas from the University of Southern North Dakota at Hopple. And would seek to learn from them. Intercontinental ballistic missile silos would be converted into training tanks for scuba divers. All around the world, people would stimulate and encourage one another's virtues. Newspapers would be filled with well-written accounts of great acts of moral beauty. And at the end of the day, people on their porches would read these and savor them and call to each other about them. Above all, in the visions of Christians and other theists, God would preside in the unspeakable beauty for which human beings long, and in the mystery of holiness that draws human worship like a magnet. In turn, each human being would reflect and color the light of God's presence out of the inimitable resources of his or her own character and essence. Human communities would present their ethnic and regional specialties to other communities in the name of God, in glad recognition that God, too, is a radiant and hospitable community of three persons. In their own accents, communities would express praise, courtesies, and deference that, when massed together, would keep building like waves of a passion that is never spent. It's good to kind of take an expansive view, I think, like that. But let me just get a couple thoughts on the table here about this corporate and individual. Yeah, go ahead.
I just have one question, sure. Or one sort of thought. We talked about conscious sin and unconscious
right.
sin, and that makes it seem like I'm in charge of my behavior all the time.
Right.
What about all those elements of me that and behaviors that come naturally to me that I'm somewhat conscious of, but mostly happen unconsciously, but I am responsible for, okay, but which may not be always the best character, you know, the best part of me?
No. Just because it comes naturally to you does not mean it's necessarily good.
Right.
Sanctifying.
Okay, but it's not necessarily always conscious.
Right.
And yet it wouldn't fall in that category of not being willful sin.
You got an example on that?
Well, it's easier for me to see in, say, let's look at some big sports people. Kobe Bryant was, you know, just arrested for rape. down in Phoenix. Yeah. It seems to come naturally to NBA stars to see the ground. Okay, sorry. Let's bail. Okay. It seems to come naturally to politicians to not necessarily tell the truth about what the CIA... there are certain positions, certain areas where flaws are come naturally because of...
Well, I think we need to ask there, how have I participated in a situation that makes... that puts politicians in a position where they need to comport themselves that way, or creates the circumstances for Kobe Bryant, probably shouldn't even, who knows what happened there, but there's a community aspect to that. But let me just for a second talk about sin and sins here. Sin and sins, okay. Paul Tillich, many years ago, toyed around with the idea of just eliminating the word sin from his systematic theology. He said, you know, this word has been so overused that maybe you can't even get the meaning back into it anymore. But he decided that it still had a certain power to it, such that probably wasn't a wise move to try to redefine it and introduce a new term. But one of the things that he helpfully clarified, I think, was that if we talk about sin, we always must talk about both understandings simultaneously. And so to do that, he used sin with a capital S and sins in the plural, which I put up here with a small s, not because one is more or less important, but just for the sake of distinction. And by sin with a capital S in the singular, Tillich was talking about something that's universal and universally tragic, as opposed to sins, which are also tragic, but much more individualized, and that there is a connection between the two. The reason that I commit my sins is because I live in a world that's full of sin, and I can't stop myself. Politicians may be caught up in a system such that sin pervading like it does, sins flow out of that. I'm caught up in a church where sin is a reality and sins flow out of that. I'm caught up in society and culture and family, even Holden Village. Holden Village is not immune from sin, by the way. It doesn't accuse anybody of that, if you didn't know that. But, I think one of the great things about Holden Village is people are honest here, pretty much, about that. That's helpful. I've had good conversations with people over the years here about that. But this is, you come however far up the valley you want, you can't get away from it. The reality of sin with a capital S is there in the fallenness of the world completely. So the idea of sin, this whole notion of sin and sins is present in one of the confessions that's right there in the LBW, if you think about it. We are in bondage to sin and cannot free ourselves. We're talking about sin, with a capital S. But we go on to say we have sinned against God in thought, word, and deed. Sins in my thoughts, my word, my deeds that flow out of that universally tragic situation. We're confessing sin, but doing it in two ways there, and that's not always very precise. It's easy to see how the tradition, we fumble and stumble with defining sin. My hunch is that when most ordinary folks today, most of us think about sin, we tend to gravitate more toward sins, the moral behaviors. Shouldn't drink, shouldn't play cards, shouldn't dance, whatever the case may be. Or our little special list of things that we think other people should not do. We tend to fall back into that language. And so part of what I'm asking of us here this week is that we take a look at ourselves and say, and how do I participate in all of this? Paul Tillich warned some number of years ago that too much focus on the individual sins would detract from keeping this bigger picture of sin in focus. And I think that'll be my constant plea, is that we try to keep both dimensions of that going at the same time. Even as we start talking about deadly sins, which tend to focus personally and privately. There are corporate dimensions to all of these, mm-hmm. and so we want to keep that balance going. Sorry, somebody had a comment here that I was cutting off. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that from my own, you know, talking about the way I see it for myself in one way anyway, is that I can see how my envy that I carry with me crops up a lot, and how my envy of others and my seeing, you know, how others live, how what others have, how that deadly center, that basic, you know, that's is how that really forms some of my sins.
Yep.
And that being in touch or being aware and more growing in awareness of each one of those deeper things in me at least helps me. I mean, I can know it, but I have to change my own behavior then. But
it's, well, since you mentioned the deadly sins, I want to let's do a little test here, see how diverse you are. What are the deadly sins anyway? Pride just about universally hits all the lists here. Okay, somebody said envy, right? Okay. And what else?
Greed.
All right.
Gluttony.
I'm going to put them in a certain order for a reason here. Greed. What else?
Sloths.
Poor animal.
What else? Lust. Lust? Somebody say lust?
Yes.
Yeah, it's usually first.
We were thinking it.
You and Jimmy Carter, man. What else?
Anger.
Now, it's an interesting. Now, a couple things we need
somebody,
to say.
Somebody asked back here where you get these.
Huh?
Somebody asked back here where you get these.
I got them right off this little nifty sheet.
Okay.
No, right here. Here's a very quick 3-minute history on the deadly sins. You might be interested to know there haven't always been 7. You know, for 15, 12, whatever. There are various biblical lists of sort of deadly sins at various places. Actually, by the time of Gregory the Great, in about 6th century, the list was getting packaged. And for a time, there were actually 8 deadly sins. Well, pride was seen as the first and overarching, and then 7 more flowed out of that. These are drawn quite a bit from biblical tradition, but not totally. Many of the desert fathers, and they were mostly fathers and not mothers, shaped this. Evagrius of Pontus, who is an Egyptian monk, probably contributed the most toward pointing to what we now today know as the 7 deadly sins. There have been various ways of grouping the deadly sins together. Certain sins relating to the bodily, material side of life, others that deal with the relational aspects of life, others that cut more deeply still into our divine-human sort of relationship. I've shared this material sometimes with high school students. We have at Trinity Seminary now a program in the summertime where we bring high school students in for 3 weeks to experience all kinds of different dimensions of seminary life, and some time with faculty and service projects in the community. And I ask them to, you know, what they know about the deadly sins, and if there are ones they would like to add. And one of the ones that they seem to come up with most frequently is prejudice. They think that's incredibly deadly, that people bring ill-formed opinions about other people that are founded on no kind of reason into human interactions and pollute the world with that. You can obviously see other, I mean, not all, or even in some ways many of the 10 commandments are reflected. I mean, where's murder and thou shalt not kill, you know, for instance. Well, one response to that is, you've got anger up here. And the deadly sins are, in some ways, misnamed. They are not in and of themselves sinful. And we'll say something about that every day. I'm going to lift up what I'm going to call the upside to each of the deadly sins. I think each one of them has a positive dimension that, if rightly employed, is to the betterment and contribution of shalom. But any good gift can be misused, overdone, bent in the wrong direction, and that's when these things become deadly, when we fail to discriminate what's helpful and not helpful. There's obviously a positive aspect of pride. That's not, I mean, you know, self-esteem and all that. Anger, what one author has called right wrath as opposed to wrong wrath, can actually contribute to the shalom of the world, but it's a fine line there that has to be watched. So in each case, there's, you know, we have to pay attention to how far things slide. The order in here that I've given you, 1 through 7, was eventually settled on after the time of Gregory, so that Christians in the church had one sin for each day of the week. That probably had as much to do for why we got to 7 as anything. It was a learning device in an age when people were not that literate and didn't have availability to books and DVDs and all that sort of thing. And so one sin for each day of the week. They assigned pride as something to pay attention to on Sunday because they thought that was the first and preeminent sin. Pride meant you were more focused on self than God, and the way you most successfully combat that is you get yourself to Eucharist on Sunday and you worship with the Christian community. That'll help you get straightened out on that one. Monday comes, and you get to work on envy. This is a continuation in some ways of your struggle with pride. Flowing out of that was the anger issue then on Tuesday. Again, you have to have a corporate sense about yourself to get over your anger. Wednesday, the famous sort of hump day, you know, you're in between worship experiences. Sloth does not mean simply laziness. We'll get to that by and by. It's really more what we might define as apathy, disengagement. Who cares? You know, whatever. That's in the modern list, we call it whatever. The desert monks discovered that sometime in the early afternoon, you all know that, I'm so glad to teach Bible studies at 9 in the morning, you know, you at 1, 2 in the afternoon, it's deadly. There's a lull when you can't focus, you don't care, you're more interested in your own needs and getting a nap or whatever. And so they put sloth in the middle of the week, recognizing that was kind of the hump day when you had to push yourself forward a little bit. And between the Sunday worship experiences, the ancient church thought you're more susceptible to spiritual indifference. So let's pay attention to that on Wednesday. On Thursday, the self-indulgence that tended to flow out of the previous day's sloth meant that you had a loss of spiritual fortitude, and greed was needing to be attended to. And greed and gluttony partner nicely, and so gluttony is the Friday sin. I don't know for sure. I think that may have had something to do with why Friday was a fast day and, don't eat meat on Friday and so forth. Keep you attentive to your bodily consumption. Saturday, Saturday night fever, I don't know, whatever. The thought, I believe, was that this sin of the body was particularly dangerous when you were now 6 days removed from the previous Sunday's worship and Eucharist and community, so you better be especially vigilant about that on Saturday when you're kind of at your lowest worship day. Bell rings right as I'm running out of things to say. Tomorrow, we're going to move just a little bit farther in our understanding of sin before we pick up with pride on Wednesday and really get into these individually. You can check the board. I forget now what the title is on that, but it'll be there.
It'll be 9.
It'll be there. 9 o'clock tomorrow. So I'm glad to stay around and have any conversation if you want, but you're free to go.